Are you a parent or coach of an athlete aged 13 to 18? Are they receiving structured athletic development coaching or just training unsupervised, copy and pasting something from Instagram or bodybuilding.com, or training with a coach who isn't even qualified or experienced with youth athletes? Do you want to help your athlete improve their movement, nutrition, and mindset? Do you want to find a coach who specializes in youth athletes, has the highest level of qualifications, has over a decade of coaching experience and a proven track record of developing athletes for regional, national, and professional levels in multiple sports? Well, listen up, because this is for you. I've recently created two ways that young athletes can now work with me. Firstly, in person within our Athlete Academy after school sessions in Edinburgh, and secondly, via the Athlete Academy Online, our online training platform for young athletes without physical access to structured athletic development support. To find out more, head to our website, www.athleticevolution.co.uk, to inquire and find out more about the Athlete Academy, helping young athletes to improve movement, nutrition, and mindset to dominate in sport and in life. This podcast episode is sponsored by Statera. Statera is a web-based application that helps youth athletes and their stakeholders estimate training load, track maturation status, monitor readiness, and manage injury. Put together by coaches working with busy youth athletes, Statera helps keep things simple and brings together the most important training information in one place to ensure that effective athlete-centered decisions can be made. No more complicated Excel tutorials and spreadsheets, just upload your athlete's data and their training schedule and start to take control of their training commitments and workload. Make more informed decisions and protect your athlete's well-being, supporting their performance. Statera takes your data very seriously. GDPR compliant and registered with the ICO, choose from a range of maturation indices and validated measures, or customize your own. Statera can record any training variable, and all your data is fully exportable. To reach out today and get a free walkthrough, head over to www.statera.uk. That's S-T-A-T-E-R-A.uk. Welcome to the Athletic Evolution Podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Amanda Johnson. Amanda Johnson has worked as a physiotherapist in high-performance sport for decades across multiple sports. This includes Great Britain aquatic teams, particularly swimming, synchro swimming, and 10 years with the GB diving team. She also travelled with the England athletics team to international camps and competitions, and served for 5 years as the England women's football team physio and senior lecturer for the Football Association. She spent 10 years as a senior physiotherapist at the Academy of Manchester United under legendary manager Sir Alex Ferguson, before becoming the lead physiotherapist at Aspire Academy in Qatar for 8 years. Amanda's research interests and PhD are related to issues and injuries suffered by developing youth athletes in all sports. Additionally, she has lectured at many international conferences on youth development, maturity, and injury. So, Amanda, welcome to the podcast. It's fantastic to have you today.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm very pleased to be here.
I'm really keen to get stuck into the wealth of knowledge that you have in this topic. So for those who haven't come across you and your work, give us a bit of a background in terms of your own journey in sport. How did you get involved in sport as a youngster, and how has that developed?
Right. Well, I'm sort of coming to the end of my career now. So I'm looking back, 50 years ago, I started in sport when I was a youngster. In those days, there wasn't the wealth of sport to get involved with, but my parents always encouraged the family. I have an older brother and sister, to go swimming, join the local swimming club, which we did, and very early on started competitive swimming. I was competitive swimmer, as an under 10 in the district, competitions, which was great, really, and it helps form a discipline. You're having to train early, at an early age, and you face setbacks and you learn to cope with setbacks, which is for me one of the greatest things about sport, is teaching youngsters how to deal with adversity. I think there's a lot of parents who in a way are trying to take all the badness, if you like, away from the children, but children need some badness to be able to cope with it in later life if things happen. And, you know, having looking back over my life, I've had lots of ups and downs, but I feel I've been able to cope with them so much better because I had lots of ups and downs in sport and was able to learn from that. So from swimming and ended up sort of training every day, twice a day. I used to go lunchtime at school and then after school. And then, you know, when I got into the senior school, I obviously got involved with the school sports program. I was probably fitter than a lot of other people around because I'd been doing the swimming for so long. And one of the PE teachers was involved with running, so I got involved with running. So I used to run to the swimming pool and do my training and then run home. So I was doing everything really as a kid, and then got involved with Sale Harriers and did cross country. And again, because I was so fit from the swimming, the running came easily to me in a way, and did the both really all the way through my school years. But in, you know, 50 years ago, the shoes weren't, and the shoes didn't have the technology they've got these days. And by the time I was 17 or 18, I was suffering severely from Achilles, peritendinitis and shin splints, which, you know, didn't help the running at all. And ended up having surgery when I was 19. So in a way that sort of, I mean, when I was at school, I was always either going to be a PE teacher or a physiotherapist. There was never anything else that came to mind. But then having gone through the surgery and then the rehabilitation from the surgery due to the sports injuries and knowing how difficult it was to get advice. I mean, I had to go down to London to see people that had the knowledge to help me deal with the problems. And had the surgery down in London, and you realise that there weren't many people that you could go to, so that obviously made me more and more interested in going into that area rather than into the PE area. So went to college. We didn't have degrees in physiotherapy in those days. It was a diploma in physiotherapy. Went to Salford, and it was good. It was one of the only mixed colleges at the time, and I can always remember being advised by a physiotherapist who was a rugby league physiotherapist at the time before I went to college. He said, don't tell anybody that you want to be a physio in sport because they won't take you on at the colleges, because at that time they just wanted physios to go into hospitals and fulfill that their roles there. So did my physio training, but at the same time, obviously, again, because you've been involved in swimming and running, I still knew people who were involved. In fact, my brother-in-law was a very successful swimming coach. So, again, he kept me involved in swimming. And I used to go down to the local squad when I was a student and do some stretching work with them and general core work with them. So I always knew I was going to be involved with sport one way or another. And then when I qualified, went with the swimmers because that's where I knew most of the people. Used to travel to sort of competitions and various, you know, national competitions with the local squad, which was a Salford squad at the time, was a successful swimming squad. And just trying to pick up as much knowledge as possible at that time. Never thinking about growth and maturity or different sizes of people, you know, that was never even considered at that time. And then again, because I'd been a runner and, you know, you keep in contact with people and coaches, you know, you see the odd runner and then, you know, because there are not many people around, you get invited to start helping teams. And I traveled a little bit with the England athletics team, did a couple of internationals with them, and then we did a little bit with the swimmers or the aquatics as they were called then. So I even traveled with a synchro team I went to the European Championships with, and then I was invited to do the World Championships for diving. And I mean, I'd done a little bit of diving in my youth, but never anything at a high level. travelled to Czechoslovakia, in the middle of Czechoslovakia, you know, with a diving team that I really didn't know a great deal about. As I say, there just weren't the physios working in sport at that level. And when we travel with teams, we never got paid for it. You know, you did it because you love sport, and, you know, you did your normal work in a hospital during the day, and then in the evenings and weekends you'd go and support teams because you love doing it, you know. And there were very, very few jobs in sport at that time. The men used to do a lot better than the women, because it was the cricket teams and the football teams. And obviously at that time they very much preferred to have men. But got involved with the diving and enjoyed that, and, you know, it was big challenges there, and ended up being with the diving team for 10 years, the Great Britain diving team, and sort of covered all Grand Prix and you know, world championships, etc. But again, with the adult side of things rather than with the youth. Did a little bit of youth. They were starting to introduce more support for the youth divers at that point. But it's very difficult in sport in many ways, apart from football, because most of the clubs would have only one or two youngsters in most of the sports. So, and there's only really football that's organised to have very young players. So football was really the only area that you could get involved with, which had a good number of youngsters within a young age group. You know, if you went into other sports, they were scattered all over the area rather than being in one place. So you have less control over what they're doing or how much training they're doing, or, you know, things like that. So, you know, travelled around with various other teams as well. I even did a little bit with the Great Britain table tennis team, and ended up being physio for a couple of matches for ice hockey, which was an experience in itself. And I've had a go at everything, really. So a big spectrum of sports, and had fun in all of them. And then decided to just give it a rest, really. I think, you know, I have a tendency to take on too much, and you know, you hit a wall. So I sort of resigned everything and decided to do a little bit of sort of locum work, really, just to sort of get my physiotherapy skills again. And then you start to get invited to travel with teams because they know you're free. So then I ended up traveling again with teams. And one of the doctors I'd worked with in a sports injuries clinic said, have you ever done anything with football? So I said, well, no, not really. So he said, oh, well, you know, this local team, it was Bury Football Club at the time, the physios had to go in hospital, and you know, the desperate, and the manager wants a qualified physiotherapist, because at the time most of the physios in football clubs were not qualified, but he wanted a qualified physio just to stand in while this other physio is away. I said, oh, I'll go and have a look. So it was probably one of the funniest things that I ever did, because I think the manager of the club was more frightened of me than I was of him, because he obviously never dealt with a woman in football. I mean, it was unheard of in those days. I think I'd only ever heard of one other lady being involved pitch side. At Wimbledon, they had a lady physio for a while, but I'd never heard or seen of anybody else. And, you know, and he was saying, oh, well, have you treated many men? And at that time, I'd been qualified for 15 years, you know, so I'd seen my share, you know, and he was just, you know, but he was desperate. So he took me on, and I was only supposed to be there for probably 2 or 3 months, ended up staying there for a few years. So, you know, and that was it, really. And once you get involved in football, it's very difficult to get out of, because people know you're involved, and they learn to trust you, and, you know, you get a knowledge. So even when you leave a particular club, and after being at this club for a few years, I, I went back into management of a private hospital, physiotherapy department. I still had footballers coming to see me. So you never really lose touch. But at that time as well, the FA had taken over the Women's Football Association, really, because they weren't, you know, part of, they weren't all the same thing at that time. It was a separate entity, and FIFA said that all the national football associations had to have a women's department. So the women were absorbed into the main football department, and I was asked to be the physio for the national team. Probably because, again, there weren't that many physios around. Women physios had got the experience of football as such, and I'd been working in professional football full-time for a number of years at that point. I also did a bit of lecturing for the FA RAND courses to help teach people how to rehabilitate injured players. As I say, many of the clubs at that time didn't have or couldn't afford to have fully qualified chartered physios. So they would have, the FA used to run courses to help people gain as much knowledge as possible to do, you know, as good a job as they could within the confines of their expertise. So I used to help with lecturing on the FA courses as well. And then, as I say, I went out of full-time football back into hospital. But the one of the surgeons I worked with in this hospital who'd encouraged me to take this new job used to do a lot of work for the PFA and also was very heavily involved with local football clubs. So we used to have professional footballers in all the time. So I never lost contact. And I was asked to do a semi-pro club. So I went to Altrincham. So I was doing that, training a couple of nights a week and then matches all over the country because they were in the conference at that time, every week, as well as doing a full-time job, as well as doing the England job. So again, you know, you take on so much. Did that for 4 or 5 years and then again hit that brick wall, gave everything up and decided to look at doing a degree because, as I said, when I qualified, the physiotherapy degrees didn't exist. And you could see all these youngsters coming through with all these degrees. And I, you know, I was getting left behind, really. So I went to do a degree in a master's degree in rehabilitation at Salford University. Did a couple of years there and then moved over to Manchester University to do a master in philosophy and then the PhD over at Manchester, which having been out of education for, you know, 20 odd years, you know, and go back in and do a master's and then a PhD, it was a huge learning experience, but enjoyable and worthwhile. And I did feel it was beneficial, the fact that I'd actually worked on the shop floor for 20 years before I went back into education, you know, because I had a completely different viewpoint from a lot of these people that had gone and done the degrees and then the masters and then the PhDs without any rest or any gaps. And I felt, you know, I approached it in a much more positive way. So I was sort of doing my masters and I hadn't started my PhD and I'd been sort of doing bits and pieces of work in private clinics and working with various teams when they wanted me to work and traveling around the world with the diving team when they needed somebody. And the job at Manchester United came up and it was for the head of the academy there. And I thought, well, I'll try, but there's no way they'll take me on because I'm a girl, you know, the typical thing. And was very surprised ultimately when they did. And, you know, I was, you know, interviewed obviously by the doc and the head physio, Rob Swire, at the time. But Sir Alex was in the interview as well. So he was very, very heavily involved in the choice and was to play a massive part, you know, in my life over the next 10 years, really, as I was there at United. So, and then, yeah, I was there for 10 years, decided I needed a change and went over to the Middle East in Qatar as a spire for 8 years. So, so that's about it, really.
It's good. I mean, there's some pretty incredible experiences in there. Like, yeah, you said, really wide grasp of everything from ice hockey to diving to football.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people say I should write a book, but, you know, I don't know. I know I've had some great fun along the way, you know, in all the different sports. I've had some real good fun and masses of experience. And just, you know, most of the time when I was going into these sports, as I say, it was early days, and you know, there was no such thing as EIS or all these, you know, places. You went into sport because you loved doing it, and people knew you. So they invited you, so they didn't know how good you were or anything, and you had to learn on your feet, really. You know, you sort of were challenged with a situation, and you had to deal with it. But yeah, you learn then, and you look for help, you know, from the coaches. I got very close to a lot of the coaches, and we had some great fun and great experiences with the coaches. And I think, you know, what it did do, and I think an important lesson for young physios is that the importance of learning to work as a team, and you know, you're no more important than anybody else, and you learn to rely on these other people, which was good. Mm. Yeah. And a lot of the time, and still happens today, you know, physios will travel with teams to big tournaments without a doctor. You know, we were always the choice. And you know, at the big championships, the world championships and European championships, et cetera, in all the sports, there'd be a doctor. But you know, if you were just travelling to Grand Prix or international tournaments, there was never a doctor. We just, you know, and I mean, I travelled all over the world with the teams, the academy teams in Manchester United. I never travelled with a doctor. You know, we just had to get on with it, really. And you know, you always had contacts. You always did your due diligence before you went away to find out, you know, where the local hospitals were and where, you know, the nearest doctor was and if the tournaments had any support and things like that. So, you know, you were prepared before you went, but, you know, you had to deal with, you know, sick children in hotels in the evening and toothache and, you know, falling over and stubbing the toe or, you know, banging the headers or chasing each other around the bedrooms and things like that. You know, you have to deal with it. It's not just the sports injuries that, you know, when you're dealing with kids that you have to deal with.
Yeah. Some might say that doesn't stop when they turn into adults.
No. You might be right, particularly in football, from what I can gather. I mean, I'm not as heavily involved with the adult side, but some of the antics I hear they get up to, it makes me wonder sometimes.
So you've obviously mentioned Sir Alex. I imagine, the environments you've been in, there will have been some characters and people that stand out as having been pretty influential. So, I mean, who are those people and what are the kind of, I guess, the big influences that they had on you?
Well, obviously, I mean, Sir Alex had a massive, he was my boss for 10 years and you know, but even before then, when I worked at Bury, the manager at the time was a guy called Sam Ellis who was, I'm saying well-connected, that seems a daft thing to say, but he had a lot of friends that used to come and visit the club while we were training, and you know, some of those friends are the old guys in football. You know, Bob Stokoe used to live around the corner. He was retired at that time, but he lived in a bungalow just two streets away from Gig Lane where we trained, and he used to come into the club just to get away from, you know, just to get in, back into football for a bit. And Ian Greaves, who'd been the manager at Bolton and various other clubs, you know, Sam Allardyce was always bobbing in. All these people, they used to come in and we used to sit and talk to them and some of the experiences. And all of them were absolutely fantastic in so much that they never treated me any differently because I was female, which I have to say did surprise me because, you know, you expect these football guys to be very, you know, uncomfortable with a woman in the, you know, in the midst when they're used to having sort of totally male environment. But I was always treated with the most respect and you know, used to listen to some fantastic stories, and they were always, you know, keen to listen to things I had to say, and you know, I learned so much off those guys as well, just about football, really. But Sir Alex was was the one that was really encouraging me in the football. And I can remember when I went for the job, you know, he said, you know, I want to know, he said, why these young kids are getting injured and have to finish playing. And I want to know, I want you to find that out. And that was just, it was as simple as that. I want you to tell me why these kids are getting these bad injuries. And at the time, there used to be a lot of kids coming over from Ireland and some very talented kids. And at that time, I mean, I'm talking nearly 20 years ago, some of these kids, you know, had shown massive talent and then got really badly injured and had to finish. And he wanted to stop that. He wanted to, you know, find out why this was happening. So that's why they, you know, the club supported me all the way through my PhD, which, you know, you're not going to get, certainly then you wouldn't get clubs doing that. Mm. And they even sent me over to America to learn how to read x-rays, to, you know, help identify some of these players that were, you know, slightly different in age, maturity age than others. So, you know, Sir Alex, I mean, he was always asking me how I was getting on, and he used to say to me, tell me in English, don't give me all this, you know, fancy language, just tell me, you know, in English what you're doing and what you found, and you know. And so he was massively supportive, and you can't help but learn things from somebody like that, and made you feel a massively important part of the whole team. You know, you weren't academy and first team. He always felt that everybody was part of Manchester United, and it didn't matter, you know, whether you were in the laundry or whether you were, you know, a first team coach or the first team doctor or physio, you know, everybody played their role, and it was as important in that sort of jigsaw of success. And so that, you know, to see somebody of that stature treat everybody as well as he did has to have a massive influence, you know, on you when you're treating, you know, when you're dealing with people yourself, you know, because you could see how successful that was, you know.
So that's really interesting. We had Andy Taylor, who used to be an academy player at Manchester United, on a couple of weeks ago. So, and that was one of the things he echoed as well, was that idea of there was one club and, you know, one kind of team, if you like. So let's dig into that a bit more. So obviously, you know, he kind of brought you on and said, I want to figure this out. So let's dive into that topic of injuries, and I guess specifically growth-related injuries. Was that what you were brought in to kind of delve into, or was it more widespread than growth?
I mean, even then, you know, you're like thinking, well, was it growth-related? Well, it was just injuries then. You weren't even thinking about what had caused them. It was just, why do these things happen? And then, you know, you look, you know, what's the difference between a child and an adult? And the big difference, obviously, is they're growing. So, you know, then you think, well, is it because they're growing that they're getting these injuries? And many of the injuries that these kids were getting were very different from adult injuries. The kids do obviously get, you know, adult injuries. You're always going to get a kid that breaks his leg, as an adult player will break his leg and you know, go over in his ankle and things like that. So the injuries that are caused through a collision with another body or a goalpost even or anything, or the floor, are very similar to what an adult player would get. But then these sort of more overuse injuries kids were getting were very different from the adult overuse injuries, and in slightly different places. So you think, well, you know, why is this? And the big difference is the way the skeleton was developing and maturing. So we decided at Manchester United with the medical team, we decided that we would actually look at the skeleton, when you look at, you know, the skeleton, when you take an x-ray of a hand and a wrist, you can very clearly see that at the end of the bones, not so much in the wrist bones, which is sort of like a jumble of bones of all shapes and sizes, but in the fingers and at the end of the forearm, you have these long bones, and at each end of those bones you have a little plate of cartilage where new bone grows, and it's from that bone that you extend the length of the skeleton. You know, you start looking at that, and you start looking at, you know, what other people have looked at, and the main player in that area of research was a guy called Bob Molina from the United States, and he'd done a lot of work. He'd looked at different children in Mexico and Native Americans and the differences between those, and he was looking at skeletons, I contacted him, and he, you know, very much encouraged me. He was a big football fan. He was a big Manchester United fan, which did help. But he encouraged me to sort of look at these skeletons and look at the difference in the development of skeletons, the hand and wrist skeleton, of children of the same age. So what very quickly became apparent was that, you know, you could have a 10-year-old boy and all very healthy, no health issues in any way, shape or form. And you could take an X-ray of his hand and wrist, and then another of his contemporaries in the same age group, and look at his development in the hand and wrist. And there may be as much as 6 years between the two in that one single chronological age group. So, you know, I can remember, you know, we used to take X-rays of all the boys in the academy at Manchester United as part of my PhD. And we used to start with the under nines and go right through to the under 16s, which is the end of the schoolboy section. And we'd have a boy, we had two boys who were virtually the same height. You know, you couldn't really tell much difference in the development. And one had a bone age or a biological age of 6, and the other one was 12. Within that same age group. So essentially what you're dealing with there is you've got a group, you know, a group of boys who are very much younger than 9 years of age. You've got a group of boys who are around 9 years of age. And then you've got a group of boys who were above, a long way above 9 years of age. So if you're a coach who comes into Manchester United as the under nines coach, bearing in mind all these boys have been scouted as being and have been identified as being special, you know, talented, they've been invited in, they don't just join, you know, it's not just a thing, they're all invited in. But as an under nines coach, where do you pitch your training session? If you've got under sixes and under 12s within the same group, and how do you know whether one's under 6, under 7 or under 10, 11 or 12? So by taking the X-ray, you can find that out very, very clearly. But obviously by doing these X-rays, there's a huge ethical consideration. But with these newer X-ray machines, the actual exposure to radiation that someone has with one single X-ray of the hand and wrist is so minimal, you can barely sort of measure it. So to measure radiation in what they call milliserves, and for one X-ray of a hand and wrist, the amount of milliserves is 0.0017. So it's a very, very minor dose. And the amount of information that you can get from that one X-ray is massive in your ability to develop these players. And also can potentially help you prevent these players from getting injured because they're not in the right group for their development. So they might be doing too much. If you're an under nines coach and just concentrate on training these boys as under nines, it means the under 12s are not getting trained hard enough. And the under sixes are having far too much. So how can you develop those boys correctly when you've got such a spectrum of ages within that one chronological age band?
Were there any other clubs doing that sort of thing at that point in time? Because we're talking 20 years ago now.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that there weren't.
No, there weren't. And there weren't. And funnily enough, I can't remember the name of the club now. There was a club in South America one of the Bocca Juniors it was. We when you start doing these things, you start talking to various people, and I got into contact with the doctor from Bocca Juniors, and they were doing it, but they were doing it because they were concerned about the boys coming out of the favelas being nutritionally deficient compared with boys coming from a more affluent area. And in fact, they found that that wasn't the case. But that was the reason that started doing the x-rays rather than looking at biological age. But they were saying that they were registering huge differences in biological age, but it wasn't from a nutritional, for a nutritional reason. But so we did these x-rays on all the age groups, and we found that in every single chronological age group, so from under nines right through to under 16s, there was a minimum of 5 years. So all of them had, about a 5 year span. So even at, under 16, we had boys who were classified as completely mature, and they were, or boys who were maybe, 13, or less. So it was a huge eye opener. And then your mind starts working. Well, if you've got this huge spread of bone maturity within one age group, is this the reason why some boys get more injured than others? So that was my PhD, was looking at bone age, looking at biological age. And they all, even today they say that the skeletal x-ray is the gold standard for looking at biological age. But it isn't common because of the radiological, exposure, and other methods are used which have been shown not to be anywhere near as accurate. But you look at the bone age, and then you look at the injuries and the types of injuries that occur, and you can see some sort of pattern, developing, and then that's when you can go back to the coaches and say, look, this young lad is, 2 or 3 years behind the other groups in his other boys in his group. If he looks as if he's struggling, maybe we just need to back off a little bit and give him a rest every so often, tell him not to come in next Thursday night, But one of the most important things that you have to do when you're dealing with kids is get the parents on board and to explain to them, to talk to them about it, and to explain that there's nothing nice and smooth about the projection from under nines to under 18s. It's a rocky road all the way, and that they have to expect that, and not to expect a constant high performance from these kids, because they won't get it. And I think that's where a lot of coaches, the less educated coaches, but a lot of parents fall foul in a way, because they'll be watching their kid who may be in front of all his peers, so he's a little bit stronger, a bit faster, and he's winning his tackles and scoring his goals because he's much stronger, he can push everybody else out of the way, and then all of a sudden his performance dips. And that's for two reasons. One, he started growing, so all of a sudden he's got an extra centimetre or two on the end of his leg, and he doesn't know how to cope with it, and he hasn't got the strength to support it or to work it. So his coordination and his balance sort of goes all over the place. And then you've got the other thing, which is where the other boys are catching him up a bit. And so he's not such an outstanding player anymore. He's just one of a lot of players. And his parents will, say, well, why is this happening? It's got to be the coaching. It's got to be the coach, I know my boy's the best in the group. He's always been the best. He's always been, the most skillful. He's always scored the most goals. Yeah, well, that was when he was nine. He's 12 now and things are changing. So one of the things that, I did and we encouraged at Manchester United, and I'm sure they still do, is to have a lot of sessions with the parents, education sessions with the parents. And basically every year we used to, at the beginning of the year, we used to say, if your boy survives this year, count it as a blessing. You know, you're lucky. You know, and at the end of the day, you know, if we could produce one or two boys every year that looks as if they were going to be outstanding players for the first team at Manchester United, we were doing a good job. You know, so just because you got into the under nines academy, it wasn't a shoo-in that you were going to make it the first team, which a lot of parents did believe. And that's why you need to educate them a lot and teach the boys how to cope with disappointment, because, you know, life isn't easy. We used to, one of the hardest things of all was to tell a parent that the boy wasn't, you know, going to be chosen to continue with the academy or was being dropped, because a lot of parents just wouldn't accept it. And you would get a lot of aggression, you know, a lot of, you know, anger. And then that used to be, you know, saying to the kids, oh, well, it's not your fault. You know, they just don't know how to look at players, or, you know, they've coached you wrongly, or you had that injury and they didn't treat you properly, so that's why your performance has dropped. So they're always looking for excuses, rather than saying, well, you know, let's see if there's somebody else that thinks you are good enough. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's been massively unrealistic in many cases. And parents need to learn to let the children face adversity, because they'll be stronger and maybe more determined at the end of it, really. And the more I see in all sports, not just in football, but in all sports, then, you know, they've got to let the kids take some responsibility and not blame it on everybody else, or, you know, just try and sort of smooth it over, because that's life, you know. Mm. And if they can learn to cope with that, then I think in later life they'll be able to deal with problems much better. Mm. So very differently in Qatar, just to say, it was very different because we, in Aspire, the kids were in a full-time school as well as being coached. So they used to be brought to school every day. They used to have transport into school, and they used to be taken home after training every night. And we very, very rarely saw the parents at all. And you know, on a number of occasions, a child would get injured during a game, and many of the games were during school time, so again the parents didn't come and watch even the games, whereas, you know, at Manchester United the touchline was rammed with parents and grandparents and aunties and uncles and everybody else. But that didn't happen in Qatar, and you know, many a time a child would be injured and would send them to Aspatar to have x-rays or see the specialist, and then send them home, and they'd be on crutches and in a brace or anything. The parents never even bothered calling us to see what had happened. You know, they just had a completely different viewpoint to sport over there, which was almost a complete opposite to what I'd experienced at United, which was very interesting. Very interesting.
So delving into some of those injuries that are unique to a younger population, to developing children, I guess it kind of makes sense to start from the bottom up. So starting with something like severs, to help our audience get a bit of an understanding of what actually is going on and what are some of the factors?
Yeah, well, basically what happens is that, as I said to you before, at the end of every bone, long bone, you have like a plate of cartilage where the new bone is generated and makes the length of the bone go longer, and around the heel area you have obviously the very big Achilles tendon, which is the tendon which is attached to the big calf muscles, and obviously when you're playing football you're using your calf muscles a lot to run and in some respects, you know, kick balance while you're kicking a ball, and that big Achilles tendon joins onto the back of the heel bone right over the top of one of these plates of cartilage, and as a child is growing, the bone, because it's changing all the time, it's developing and growing in length, etc., is a lot weaker and more like almost like a shell it's like a very brittle. And the muscles and the tendons are a lot stronger. And the weak points are actually where the muscles and tendons attach to the bone. And if you're doing a lot of running and jumping, those attachments are getting pulled and pulled and pulled as the muscles are worked. And the more work you do, the more the pull is. And if they're right over the top of a growth plate, that growth plate becomes very irritable and causes pain. And Sever's disease is basically an inflammation of that growth plate that's in your heel, right bang where the Achilles tendon joins onto the back of the heel. And it's interesting in so much that as a child grows, they mature, so the bone becomes fully mature from the bottom upwards. So the first area in a skeleton, in a youth skeleton to mature is the heel, then the knee matures, and the last thing to mature is the hip and pelvis area. So what you see is, in football particular, and in some jumping and running, other running sports, in things like rugby and running sports, the Sever's disease will occur around about 9 and 10, when that plate is very active as it's trying to mature. The Sever's disease is usually in that sort of time frame. And then that settles down. And then when they get to about 12 and 13, the growth plates around the knee, and you have two growth plates around your knee. You have one at the end of the shin bone, and right on there's a bump on the top of the shin bone, which is a very big attachment to the quadriceps tendon, which is the big tendon that comes from the four big muscles on the front of your thigh. And if you think of how many times you must use those to run and kick and balance and things, so that tendon is pulling on the front of that bump on the front of your shin time and time and time again during training and matches. And again, as that's trying to mature, that becomes very inflamed and very irritable and very sore. And probably that area, which is becomes inflamed, is called Hodgkin's Lattice. And that's probably the most common of all the growth-related injuries that you get in football, and one that a lot of people have heard of. And then down at the bottom of the kneecap, the kneecap is like a little triangle, and the flat bit is sort of at the upper pole, and then it goes into a point. And there's another attachment for tendon there, and that can become very inflamed, and that's called Sindig Johansson-Larsen disease, which is again exactly the same as Hodgkin's Lattice, exactly the same as Sever's. It's just a sort of attraction of the muscle tendon on the bone. On a very fragile bone. And then latterly, sort of 16, 17, 18, youth players tend to get a lot of problems around the hip and the pelvis as that's starting to mature. And there are about 10 or 12 areas in the hip and pelvis that you can get these growth-related areas where these big thigh muscles and hip muscles join on. And you can get a lot of if you take x-rays and scans of a pelvis of a 16 and 17 year old, it looks like they've really been moth-eaten the bone because of the problems that they've had. But if they're given rest and they're given the proper rehabilitation, that will all settle down. So usually, as I say, 9 and 10, it's from the heel, then it moves up to the knee to around about 14 or 15, and then goes up into around the pelvis and the hip. And again, another big area in football and in cricket is the low back, where you can get stress fractures. And that, again, is usually 14, 15, 16. And that is usually sort of a combination of, they think, sort of a rotation and a bending backwards or an extension on the bones of the back. And you can get cracks forming in the lower part of the vertebra. Which obviously can cause pain and an instability of the spine if both sides crack at the same time, which is not uncommon. And one thing I would say is that, I mean, the pain in the heel and the knee and the pelvis with rest, you know, will settle down. There's no evidence that by playing with this discomfort is going to cause problems later on in life. It's not going to cause any disability or anything. So as long as the pain is manageable, then it's not you know, you don't have to stop. But what you have to be careful of is that if this pain is bad enough, it may alter the way the boy or girl runs and performs. And if there's any alteration in posture or running style, then it's obviously bad enough to make them alter the stance. So that has to be stopped. So if there's any alteration in posture, then they need to stop running, because it could cause problems elsewhere. But one thing is that if you ever have a youngster, a boy or a girl, who complains of back pain, that needs to be investigated, because back pain isn't something that a child will complain of. And they only complain about it if they have pain. And the most common cause of back pain, probably in a sporting child, is a stress fracture. So if you have a child that complains regularly about back pain and it's not settled with conventional physiotherapy, and I mean manual physiotherapy, and I don't mean mobilization or manipulation, obviously, because if it's a stress fracture, that could cause more problems. Then it needs to be investigated, because it is likely to be a stress fracture. The other thing that I would advocate is that I was always taught by another very influential physio when I was at college. He was a Great Britain physio for the Great Britain Rugby League team, and he always used to say to us that there are no plugs in the middle of a football field or a rugby pitch. So if you have an injury, you have to deal with it. You can't just plug your patient into a machine and think they're going to get better. So machinery is not something, you know, ultrasounds and a lot of this electrotherapy is not something I've ever used on children, because some of it's contraindicated. It can be harmful when you're actually working over growth plates. It can actually cause problems with the growth plates. So I just don't bother using it at all, and just use exercise therapy and rest and core stability, correct stretching, posture, and those things are far more important when you're dealing with kids.
Yeah. So one of the kind of, I guess, maybe potential misconceptions is that growth-related injuries are just a part of growing up, which I guess to some degree is the skeleton's changing, they are. But is there a training load issue going on that maybe can be better monitored or adapted to help reduce or minimise some of the effects?
Well, we don't know. To be honest, we don't know. Growth-related injuries are part of, you know, growth. We know that, obviously. And you know, people talk about growing pains in kids, and that is true. Some of these kids who are not injured but are growing, they have tremendous pain, and a lot of it is because they're growing so rapidly. Again, when I was dealing with the young divers and the young swimmers, some of these kids were growing that quickly, they were getting stretch marks. So, you know, it's a massive growth, and you know, some, you know, up to 2 centimeters in a month. Well, that's, you know, just short of an inch. Well, to be growing that much and to be doing, you know, heavy training sessions, which some of them are doing, and to try and get the body to accommodate to this new growth, you know, all the muscles are being stretched, all the ligaments are being stretched, you know, the bones are weak, because as they grow, a bone, the outer shell of a bone grows, but it's hollow. So that's another reason why they're so weak. And then you've got all these big, strong muscles working on these hollow bones. It's little wonder they become irritable and painful. So growing pains are a real thing. You know, these growth-related injuries, well, not really injuries. This is the problem, you know. In a way, I always used to try and say to the kids, if they've got pain when they're growing, it's a good thing because they're growing. You know, if they don't get any pain at all, is it because they're not growing? You know, so So try and put a positive spin on these things and say, well, you know, all right, it's a bit, you know, it's a bit painful now, but it means that you're growing and you're getting stronger and, you know, you'll be able to play better or perform better. So it's to put a positive, and the same with the parents as well, you know, try not to sort of dwell on it being, you know, they call it Hodgkin's disease, you know, it's not, you know, it becomes something awful, and it's not, in a way, it's just a consequence of rapid growth and, you know, training. But we don't know how much training is good or bad. This is the thing. And that's something that, you know, we hope to look at Aspire. The difficulty is, how do you judge, you know, how much training these kids are doing? Because you go to, you know, an academy and you've got, you know, the under 9s, 10s or 11s. And all right, they might go for 5 sessions a week. But actually, how much training they're doing when they're there? Because, you know, you're always going to get the one or two that will never stop running. They're running around all over the place. But you're always, then you're going to get in the same session boys who are stood on the edge and don't do as much because sometimes they don't want to be there. So you can't compare the two, because they're doing different training loads. So it's very, very difficult to judge how intense a training load a lot of these kids are doing, unless you monitor them more carefully. And really, probably the only way that you can monitor them is through a GPS system of some description. But how many clubs could afford to GPS monitor all their age group teams when a lot of them can't afford to do the adult teams? So, I mean, what we have done at Aspire, I mean, before I left, they managed to get a GPS for all the football teams. They start at under 12s right through to 18s, and they were monitoring them on a sessional basis with GPS. So now we'll have probably 3 or 4 years of GPS training load for each individual, alongside all the injury data that they're getting, alongside the biological ages. So we're now looking into all that data to try and then say, right, well, this boy whose biological age was 10 and he should have been 13, you know, he did this much training compared to his colleagues and he had this many injuries compared to his colleagues. So, and this type of injury, you know, that's what we're going to be looking into, and that's going to be important. But unless you're doing the assessment of a biological age, you don't know, you know, if one set of training criteria is going to be detrimental to this child against that child.
It's interesting. I had Jamie Salter on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and he's currently completing his PhD in exactly that, you know, giving a prescribed training load and seeing how people of different biological ages respond, etc. But sometimes it's difficult to give parents, you know, when to turn around and say, we don't actually know, because we haven't studied it enough yet. And sometimes, you know, people want a yes or no answer. It's like black and white. It isn't black and white, is it?
No, I mean, there's nothing black or white in any medical field, is there? But particularly with kids. And as I say, you know, one of the things that I noticed in United and Qatar, because I was doing the skeletal x-rays in Qatar as well, you can take all these x-rays of kids and they might be a 12-year-old boy. He might be 12. His x-ray comes out at 12. And so you take it again the next year and you would expect it to be 13. Well, it might be 15. It might be 12.2. So there's no guarantee that every year, every 12-month period, the biological age is going to change by 12 months, because it doesn't happen. Just doesn't happen. And, you know, we know that there are late developers and normal developers and early developers. But what we're seeing in all the masses of data that I've got, nearly 2,000 x-rays now, and some of them on boys over a period of 6 or 7 years, what I'm seeing is that some boys will be a late developer when they're 10, but then might be an early developer when they're 16. So it's very difficult to say no late developers make it into the academy at 16, because those early developers at 10 may now be the late, you know, the late developers at 10 might now be the early developers at 16. So it's not as simple
That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. It's a bit like a Formula One race, isn't it? You might start in the back and then overtake each other.
There's no guarantee that they stay in the same band all the way through. So if the under 12 age, at 10.1, they might then jump 2 or 3 years. And this is the thing. This is the problem that we can't. There was a study done at Clairefontaine in the French Academy in the 2000s, and it was a great study, and it was done over 10 years. And when the boys arrived at under 14s, they were all given an X-ray that was measured, and then they were labelled late, normal, or early developers, and they kept that label all the way through the time at Clairefontaine. And that was a big mistake, because it may change year on year. So this is the difficulty, and it's something that the coaches need to understand as well, that there's nothing set in stone with these kids. It's a very rocky road, a very bumpy road, in the way they develop, the way they change, and not just sort of physically, but emotionally along with that, which obviously is running parallel at the same time. I had great relationships with most of the coaches at Manchester United, and we used to have some really big goalkeepers, and they'd be 6 foot when they were 14 or 15. And on occasion they would be given the opportunity to train with the reserves or even more, and they were treated because they were so big. Sometimes the coaches used to forget that they were so young, and they would be treated the same as reserve team players, and they would be shouted at and everything. And I used to say, "Hey, hang on, these kids, you've got to be very careful with them, because they don't understand yet that you're not shouting at them." Then personally, it was a sort of a general, this is the way football training is, and you have to be very careful emotionally that you're not putting too much pressure on these kids. But because they were 6'2" and 6'3", they forget, and you have to be very, very careful.
What you see isn't always what you get. Just because someone looks like an adult mentally, they're not an adult yet.
Absolutely. And I mean, they were like adults. They were big, they were strong, they'd got beards, some of them, but they were still only, 15. So, physically they may well be, big, strong lads, and, and the coaches have great expectations and expect them to perform in a particular way. But emotionally, they were nowhere near. And the performance isn't just physical, it's a combination of the physical and emotional. So, just because they're big and strong doesn't mean to say they're going to be able to perform. So that has to be reckoned into the equation as well.
So based on your, wealth of experience and your research, what things do you think parents and coaches need to be mindful of and keep at the forefront, when they're looking at their young performer or their young athlete developing across a season, across multiple seasons? What are the things that you would say, these are the really important things to come back to?
Well, going back to Sir Alex, really, what he used to say, I'm not bothered about how good a kid is at 12 or 13 or 14. All I want you to do as an academy staff is give me a player at 17 and 18 that's going to be good enough to play in the first team. And that's what parents and coaches need to understand. That how good they are at 12 or 13 is immaterial in the long term. Nobody remembers the best under 12 at Manchester United, but they'll remember the best first team player. So why... don't get over involved in these age group tournaments, these age group competitions, win at all costs, because it doesn't matter in the long term. And we've got to look at long-term development, not 12-year-old development or 13-year-old development, because in a way there is no such thing, because they are so mixed up. So what all the parents need I'm being too simplistic, but the parents have got to trust the people that are dealing with the development of their children. And the coaches have got to understand development. And I would say, you know, the FA put various age group coaching sessions on now, and there's a lot more awareness about different age groups, but it's still a big thing, an unknown quantity for the parents. And the parents have got to trust the coaches and the medical staff in the development of their child, and not get bogged down in how well the kids are training, because the kids will always, you know, on the whole, do the best. And if they're not, or if there's a problem, that will be flagged up to them by the medical staff or the coaches. But don't put pressure on the kids. Don't be giving them a lecture on the way home in the car, you know, if they don't think they scored enough goals, you know, at the weekend, because it doesn't matter. All that matters is when they get to the age of 17 or 18, they're a well-rounded, good skilled, strong, robust player that has a future as a senior player, because that's all that matters. That's what an academy is there for, is to produce senior players, not to produce good age group players.
I couldn't agree more with you. And I have this conversation with people all the time saying, I'm not interested in 15-year-old world champions. Okay.
No. I mean, we used to go, I went away over 10 years. I must've done 50 or 60 tournaments with Manchester United kids all over the world. We went, you know, America, flipping Hong Kong, Mauritius. We went all over. I mean, we had a ball. We had a great time. From under nines, we took away right through to, you know, obviously 17s and 18s, to these tournaments. And in the whole, and I must have done 50 or 60 tournaments. And in all those tournaments, I think we only got to one final. And the reason for that was when these kids were being scouted, and again, Sir Alex had a big part in this. He, you know, I used to talk to him and used to tell him all about these different age groups. And he used to talk to the scouts and say, look at when the birthdays are. Don't just pick the biggest boys. If you see there's a kid that's got a bit of skill, we'll bring him in, you know. And on a couple of occasions, we'd got, you know, longitudinal data to show that they were 2 or 3 years behind their contemporaries. But they were very skillful. And the coaches used to come to the point, obviously at 16, when they were saying, you know, do we take them on or not into a full-time capacity? And they say, well, they're very small, you know, he's not going to make it. And I used to say, look, he's 2 or 3 years behind everybody else. You can see the data here, you know, but when he's 21 or 22, he's going to be, you know, 6'1" or 6'2", because the other thing that you can do with a skeletal x-ray is predict the height of the player or the boy or even the girl. So they might only be 5'2" now, but when he's fully grown at 21 or 22, because that might be where they, you know, they go to, he's going to be 6'3". And at United, they, you know, on a couple of, they used to say, right, we'll give him a chance. You know, we'll take the chance. And then, you know, that boy would shoot up at 16 and 17 rather than at 13 and 14, like some other boys did. But at least we'd got the proof that the potential was there for them to do that. And every, you know, there was every indication that that's what was going to happen. So, you know, that was the thing, you know. If you've got a projection of height, and you can do that without using x-rays, it's not quite as accurate, but, you know, you can do it. And a lot of people do it. But, you know, don't, you know, just think because they're small at 16, they're going to be small at 21. I mean, we had a goalkeeper that grew 7 inches from the age of 16 to the age of 21, you know. And at first, oh, he's never going to be big enough for a goalkeeper. I said, no, just wait, just be patient. And you know, that was Sir Alex, just be patient. And he used to, you know, say to the coaches and to the scouts, you know, look at, and if the other thing to say to a parent is, in the outfield players, obviously a goalkeeper and probably the centre half is a very important position for them to have a stature. They have to be tall. You can't get around that. But if they're good enough, they're big enough in other positions, because they've got masses of examples of top class centre forwards that were only, you know, 5'7", 5'8". You have, you know, masses of examples of midfield players who were the same. I mean, you only need to look at Paul Scholes, you know, to say, you know, and he was never a big lad. So, you know, don't worry about height apart from your goalkeeper and your centre-half. But then going back into this sort of biological thing, if you're doing these x-rays at 9 and 10, and you do an x-ray at 9, and you do one at 10, you do one at 11, and each one of these is predicting that child to only be 5'6", 5'7", they're never going to be big enough to be a goalkeeper or a centre-half. However accurate you measure them, you're not going to be 5 or 6 inches out. So if you've got prediction at 9, 10, 11, so I would always say do 3 consecutive years. And each one of those, you're only getting 5'7", 5'8". Then they're not going to be a goalkeeper. Even if they want to be a goalkeeper, they will never make it as a goalkeeper. So that's a better opportunity then to encourage them to change the position, to keep them in football, rather than keeping them in football till the 15 and 16 and say, well, you're not big enough. And then go out of sport altogether. So you know, it's important. And it's the same with the centre-half. If they're, you know, not going to be big enough as a centre-half, then put them as a defending midfielder or as a full-back, if that's what they want to be, a defender. But then if they're not going to be big enough for centre-half, don't keep them in that position and then take them out of that position because they're not going to be big enough when you've known them not going to be big enough all the time.
That's something we're working on with Scottish rugby, because we have a history. Our last 3 international hookers all started as back rowers. And then they realised they didn't fit that profile and move forward. But we have that conversation. Can we do that earlier? Can we identify this earlier and say, actually, he's never going to be a back row. Let's get him throwing the ball now.
And that's right, because then they learn the position better at an earlier age. And I mean, I can remember doing a little bit of work with the Sailing Association, because they have obviously all these different types of boats, the yachts that they use, and even windsurfing. They like windsurfers to be very tall. Well, if you've got a windsurfer that's only ever going to be 5'2", maybe he needs to be put somewhere else. And that's what they did at the time I was doing it, was match the boats to the heights they were going to be in as adults. So they learnt that boat, you know. And you know, it's the same with football. And you know, I can remember reading an x-ray for another club, actually. A boy who was a very talented goalkeeper, but he was also a very talented cricketer. When I'd measured his height and I'd, you know, explained it to the parents, and I said, look, this is only a one-off and I don't really like doing it as a one-off. I like doing, you know, 2 or 3 consecutive ones. But as a one-off, he was only going to be about 5'9". So, well, there is the potential that he's not going to be tall enough for a goalkeeper, you know, but at that time, in the position he was playing in cricket, which he was very good, you know, it didn't matter. And he actually went over and played county cricket, you know, because he knew he wasn't going to be big enough as a goalkeeper, which for me was great, because it meant he wasn't lost to sport. I'm not bothered what sport, as long as he keeps in sport. Whereas if they had not done the test and kept him in as a goalkeeper, and then he'd have been released at 16 because he wasn't going to be tall enough, he would have lost his opportunity to be a cricketer. He wouldn't have found a position in really any club as a 5'10" goalkeeper. So what does the kid do, you know?
I think that's really interesting, because effectively you're increasing their chance of success. But if the parents are so single-minded, saying, no, he has to be this position, well, actually, it's going to be very tough for him.
And it's the same, you know, I mean, I've got a great nephew who's he's 9, and he plays local football, and he plays in the goal. And I'm saying, don't play him in the goal all the time. And you know, below the age of 12, no kid should say, I'm a goalkeeper, or I'm a forward, or I'm a midfield. They should be playing every week in different positions, because they don't know. And it's not until you get to sort of 12 or 13 that really they should be encouraged to start, you know, and the coaches then, who are in the best position to be able to recognise the qualities of the player, should then be encouraging them to seek a more, you know, favourable position to maximise the potential of that child, you know. And knowing the height at an early age means you can maximise the potential of that child. So not putting him in an area that he's never going to succeed. He might do for a while, because he might be an early developer and bigger than everybody else at the moment. But by the time he's 13 or 14, everybody's caught up with him. So maximize the potential as early as possible, which will, you know, if they're going to stay in sport, it means they're more likely to stay in sport because they've got the position that's going to suit them physically as an adult, you know, and they can learn more and more and more about these positions that they're having to play in, you know. So, and you know, this is, you know, it does irritate me when, you know, the parents will bring the kids in at nine. Oh, he's a goalkeeper, or he's a, you know, he's a centre forward. Just give him time. Just let him play. Let him enjoy. Let him experience all these other positions. And let's see, you know, he might be a, you know, a great centre forward, but he might be a better defender. But you've never allowed him to play as a defender, you know. And you know, and it's, a kid doesn't choose. He's usually, you know, his dad will say, oh, you go and play up front and score some goals. You know, this is the thing. So they'll do whatever they want. The parents want them to do, you know. So the parents should just take them down, let them play, let them experience different positions. Let's see over a period of time how they're developing, what they like to do, you know, what their strengths and weaknesses are. And then around about 12 or 13, when they start playing, you know, 11 aside, then let's start looking at being a little bit more specific in the positions that they're playing that's going to suit them physically. And mentally, of course.
Well, I mean, I want to be mindful of your time because I want to honour that. But last, if someone was interested, but, you know, maybe like Sir Alex Ferguson wants it in English, what are there any sort of resources you would point them to kind of start to delve into this world of growth and maturation and understanding these things?
It's difficult because I don't think the experts know, you know, the consequences of it yet. I think they're becoming far more mindful of it, and I know you've spoken to Sean, and the ways that, you know, the Football Association are using biobanding and trying to sort of equalize fairness and size in competitions. And I would just say, you know, to the parents to talk to the coaches and the medical staff in the academies. There are very few texts apart from the academic texts, which is, you know, where your physios and your coaches would get the information. I wouldn't recommend that parents delve into those. But on the sort of the UK sport websites and things, they do discuss, you know, growth and how they're trying to, you know, look at various ways of tackling sort of inequalities, if you like, of physical sizes in all different sports. All different sports have got their sort of blueprint on how they deal with youth sport and the development of youth sport. And whatever sport that you know you're involved with, you know, the association will likely have a growth and development program that you can get some good information from as a parent. But as I say, the best thing is to sit and talk to the coaches and the medical staff to get an understanding that, you know, not for them to get too heavily involved. Let the child develop in his own way. But ask questions. Certainly don't sort of ignore things. Ask questions. Just support and encourage rather than criticise.
And then you've also got a bit of some input into a course that I mean, is it Ben Bradley that's been leading it into the kind of generation of that?
Ben's sort of got everybody together, and this is a sort of an athlete development project that he's leading, and one of the sort of the modules in that is growth and development. So it's all aspects of growth and development. That's more again from a professional standpoint, really, rather than from a
layman. Coaches.
Yeah. So the various things. I mean, I've done a presentation on, you know, skeletal maturation and injuries and things like that. So I've done two or three there, but that's, as I say, more for the professional, because again, you know, you go on your physio courses and things like that, and there are very few that are dealing with children in elite sport. Mm-hmm. It's trying to sort of maximize that knowledge to as many people as possible, really. That's what we're aiming to do.
So for those who might be you know, interested, I guess, like coaching wise, etc., to find out a bit more about you and your work, is ResearchGate the best place to find those?
All my information's on there.
Yeah, so we can forward people onto to that if they want to read some of your research and.
Yeah, all my papers are on there, mainly all to do with some aspect of injury or growth or, you know, combinations of of all those different things, you know. And as I say, it's the same in every sport. That, you know, it's the injuries are very similar, and you know, in all sports, it's just some sports have more specific injuries than others. But you know, all the kids still have to go through this process. You know, if you can understand it, then it's easier to help them through it. Yeah.
Well, I knew we were going to get a masterclass on growth and maturation injuries, but we also got a masterclass on sport coaching and talent development as well. So thanks so much for your time today. It's been amazing.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm glad to help.
I just want to say a quick thanks to everyone who has left a podcast review so far. It's been fantastic to see what you guys are making of the podcast and really enjoy reading them. Rest assured, I do read every single one. So thanks again. And if you haven't left a review yet, it would do us a massive favor if you would, as that would help us grow this community and reach more grassroots coaches who will benefit from these conversations. So thanks again, and we really appreciate it.